Welcome back to the Jane Q Public Podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Qureshi, and today I have a new friend, as in a friend I just met. And I will also say that he is my first Mastodonian that I have had on the podcast. Adam P. Knave, that is K-N-A-V-E, very saucy name, is here with me today from Portland, Oregon. Is that right? Portland?
That is right. I like how you specify new friend and then as a friend you just made, as opposed to I am not a baby. Just be assured, I have grown past the point I can speak.
No, but you know, like, I mean, new to the pod, like, not just new
I
to the
know
podcast,
what you mean, but if I can't. To me. This is what you get. This is your own fault.
Okay, I'm ready. And I would just like to let everyone know that Adam P. Knave he's lubed up. He's done with work. He's done with his week. He's cracked one open. And so this is going to be a very fun conversation.
Yes, done with the day job, but there are still writing deadlines that, you know, lurk.
Don't writers write best when they're drinking? Isn't that a thing?
You know, I grew up with writing. My family is involved in printing far back enough that my mother's father and all my uncles were actually in like physical printing, like, you know, typesetting.
Wow. Yeah.
And my mother and father both were writers and editors. And I will tell you something, that ain't true. There is always that great legend of, like, you know, like, write drunk, edit sober. And there are people who need like a little bit of drink, and it's just to knock the edges of fear off. Because any creative endeavor, right? The first thing, I would actually argue, the only thing that matters is not having any fear.
Wow.
Everything
I agree.
Else is essential. Yeah. Is rather not essential. Like, you can just learn that stuff. But, yeah. You know, if you can combat the fear, then you're fine. And I've known people who just, you know, you need like a drink or so to tamp that fear down.
I think that's right. Because, like, I think there's also I want to say sort of tragic history of good writers who've sort of gotten stuck in that pit.
Societally, we like to push up both the broke artist and the drunk and drug-addled artist, be it musician, painter, writer, whatever, partially so we can look down on them, because a lot of society despises the fact that artists exist because they can't do this thing that affects you this way. And the more you convince them that they should just be wretched and sad and broke and poor, it means you don't have to pay them as much.
Oh.
So, you know, all the creative people I know who actually get anywhere and do anything are always striving to be a little healthier, both mentally and physically. And again, like I said, I know people who need a drink or two before they write. God bless them. I am not one of those people. I actually, if I've had as much as like, and I have a decent tolerance, but if I've had a drink, it won't touch me. But I still will not write or edit that night if I can help it.
Oh, that's
like even
so
like 6 hours later.
Yeah. Do you do any kind of like brainstorming or any kind of like any creative work that just sort of, you know, because like there's stuff where you might do stream of consciousness, or you might just like, I don't know, sketch stuff out or whatever, and, you know, and I don't just mean alcohol, but whatever your thing of choice is, you know, it kind of helps you loosen up, and then you can pick whatever is useful out of it when you're ready to go.
I'd rather just go in just, you know, stone cold sober and just see what the nightmares are in my head. It's more fun that way.
Okay, well, I respect this completely, and frankly, I'm not like a, I am
but again,
not
I don't
a
judge,
at all.
You know, like, I don't
all.
Judge.
Yeah. But I'm
know
just
people,
curious, yeah.
Oh, you know, look, the best coder I've ever met in my life coded twice as good stoned as sober. And I've never met anyone else for who that is the case, but hey, it worked for him. So, you know, I don't judge. It whatever works to get the weird brain connections clicking is what you should probably be doing, so long as it's, you know, relatively safe.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a little bit about this in a second, because it kind of ties into what I wanted to jump off with originally, a conversation you and I had on Mastodon or an exchange. But before I do that, I want to ask you a icebreaker question, because clearly you need it.
Yes, we are so stiff and
Yes.
Too regulated here. We have to loosen up, obviously. Yeah.
All right. No. So what's the last book that you read?
Oh, see, that's a terrible question.
No.
No, and I'll tell you why. I think it's a more interesting answer than the last book I read. So like 3-4 years ago, like just before the pandemic, I realized I suddenly needed reading glasses as well as my normal glasses.
Oh dear.
And instead of getting trifocals, I went with like 2 pair of glasses. But for like a good like 6 months to a year before that, I had basically stopped reading a lot because I was having trouble seeing pages. It's a good reason. And then there was this little pandemic that we're still kind of in, and it broke everyone's brains, including mine. And like I've read like 2 or 3 books in the last 2 years, but that's about it. Like I used to like read like a book a week.
Yep.
And the last couple years, I have a Pratchett here. God help me, I have a Pratchett I've never read. There's still a few. I'm working my way through them in order. And I'm still like halfway through Monster's Regiment, and it's been like, I don't know, 2 months. And that's insane to me.
Yeah.
But I changed up some of my like sleeping habits where I used to read right before bed, and I stopped doing that, so I try to actually sleep. And the needing to switch out the glasses and the whole thing, it's just kind of stopped me from reading as much. And I need to fix it. And I just haven't gotten to yet.
But you know what? I also think that, like, and I think this is true not just about our reading habits, but like pretty much everything in our lives that we care about, including relationships. There are like peaks and valleys. Because there were times, especially like when my kids were little, I would go years without reading a proper book, right? And now I'm back into it. And I actually never thought, like at a certain point, I was like, I'm just never going to be a reader again. I gave it up. And then just, you know, recently, I got really back into it, and it's like I never stopped. But I think that that's normal, and I don't think that it's a bad thing.
I know, I agree. Like, I've gone through like 6 month to a year periods. I've never gone quite this long. Mm. But again, it's just I haven't had time to find like a new place in the house to read or time, because I'm used to using my days differently. And trying to rejigger like decades old habits with adjusting to pandemic stuff and everything else, just it all gets lost in the mix. So, you know, I haven't been reading much. I'm trying to think, like, what was the last actual, like, full book I read? Actually, I can tell you what it was. It was Jason Pargan, Zoe Punches the Future in the Dick. That's what it was. Jason Pargan, who used to go by David Wong.
Uh-huh.
Back when he worked at, well, before, but also he worked at Cracked for a bunch of years.
Yeah.
Wrote a book called John Dies at the End. And I was reviewing books for a number of places, including Publishers Weekly at the time. And he had self-published this book, and I came across it, and it became one of my all-time favorite books, and still is. And he started another series a couple years ago, the Zoe Ash series, which is kind of a newish take on cyberpunk stuff, and brilliant. And the big thing, and he started going by Jason Pargan, which is his actual name, is that he has the best titles in the business. You know, the three Zoe Ash books.
I can see that.
Yeah. Right, well, the three Zoe Ash books, the third was just announced as, you know, coming sometime in, like, fall or something like that. But the first one is Futuristic Violence and Fancy Suits. And then Zoe Punches the Future in the Dick. And shortly, Zoe is Too Drunk for This Dystopia.
Wow.
Just, I have always been so mad at him for how great his titles are.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I want to read those books now.
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very effective. Well, thank you for answering that question.
Had to think a minute.
No, it's fine. Like I don't, people have really weird ideas about, you know, what they should be reading and what and how often and what, and is an audiobook a book or whatever. I mean, I'm not that person. And if you tell me, you know, the last book you read was you revisited, you know, The House at Pooh Corner because that's what sounded good. I got all the respect for that, right?
Here I can tangent no again if you want.
Yeah, go.
When I was a kid, because my father was a science fiction writer, when I was a kid, I never really read a lot of the children's classic books. Like, I went from, like, basically Dr. Seuss to, like, the Heinlein Juvie novels.
Uh-huh.
And so when I was around 18 or so, and I was living in Boston, I was going to college, I started reading all the kids' books, like Peter Pan and, you know, and Pooh and Alice in Wonderland, and like all my friends are like, what the hell is going on here? And I'm like, I need to culturally just figure out, like, what did I miss? Except I came to them all way too late. Not that they don't work, but if you go back and read Pooh now, it is a very different thing.
Mm.
You know, you
can't tell me
it. I mean, well, I kind of don't know because I didn't read it the other way, but it's not like just some innocent little child story. It's like the best example, I think, is actually Wizard of Oz.
Right.
When you read it as a kid, say, or like watch a movie, you're just like, oh, this is this fun thing. And you don't realize it's this big socialist tale.
Oh, yeah. Dude, that's the thing about children's books. Like, all good children's books are actually adults' books written for children.
Right.
Or adult themes written for children.
Right. Yeah. There's just some paint over it. And so because I didn't read them when I was a kid, I only came to them later. Like, I was just like, oh my God, like, does no one else realize this is happening? You know, it was a little surreal for a bit there.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree with that. And I read a lot of science fiction when I was younger, but I never, for whatever reason, read Ursula Le Guin.
And oh, that's
so now
a shame.
So now that I've started, and it's like, holy shit, I'm ready to start a revolution, right?
Right.
And I can only imagine the impact that would have had on me when I was younger, or maybe not. Maybe I wouldn't have had the sophistication enough to really understand what she was saying and why she was saying it. But these books, and I think speculative fiction is, this is what it's the best at, is helping us think through really serious issues and what our outcomes could possibly be.
It's one of the things that I always laugh at when there's like that whole like, oh, it's just genre fiction. Like, as opposed to what? Because first of all, you're like straight, I don't know, Dickens, shall we say? Right?
Okay.
You're straight normal narrative fiction. Can we just lump Dickens in on that? I don't know.
Sure, why not? I don't know. I have a friend who, she's very passionate about Dickens, so if she listens to this, she might have something to say. But
and again, there's nothing wrong with that, but guess what? That's a genre, too. It's that thing of, like, just because it's your default doesn't mean it's not part of the set. So, you know, saying, like, oh, genre fiction, everything is genre fiction. I mean, genre it's just a type of a subset of a thing. You can't say there's genreless fiction.
Yeah.
That's not a thing. That's just physically impossible, right? That's called blank pages. But getting away from that, like, all genre fiction has always, at its best, been a reflection of who we are married to either what we fear or what we hope.
Yeah.
That's right. That's it. That's the magic, right? Like, as somebody who's studied this their entire lives and writes it, that's the entire trick. You know, I got my start writing horror. And I'll tell you, the first thing I learned in horror, the only monsters that are actually scary are people.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I've heard this, actually.
Yeah. Everything else is weak.
I was reading something. I think it was Oscar Wilde who said this, because I'm on a little bit of a binge of his stuff too. But it was something about writers, or maybe it wasn't him, but I don't know. But I read a quote recently about how good fiction, or writing tells the truth and fiction tells the most truth, or something like that. Basically, the idea being that the only way we can cut past our, you know, cognitive biases is to use fiction to help us to get to the truth, right? Because it disarms us. It really, you know, gets past all these like things that we've set up about who we want to hear things from. And so when you read something that's so artful, and often it's not until, you know, a long time after you're done reading it that you start reflecting on the meaning of the story and, you know, what its implications are for you and for society and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think fiction is about truth telling, for sure.
I mean, it has to be, right? Like that, I mean, in a weird way, like it kind of by definition has to be, because all myth is truth telling, all story is essentially truth telling, because, and this is a weird way it's not exactly a scientific proof, but there comes a point in anything that I'm working on, like whether it's a comic or a novel or anything, where I realize that I could probably just write this as like a 500 word blog post. Like, strip away all the bullshit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Remove all the characters, like just and this is actually something I always tell my editing clients, actually, is at the core, before you start plotting, figure out what do you want to say to the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Just that very simple idea, whatever it is. You know, it could just be like, I don't like ham. I don't care. but figure out what it is that you're trying to say. And then once you are sure that that is the thing, when you start plotting, you kind of quietly hang everything off of that rope. And then when you start working, ignore the rope, because it's already infected everything you're doing. At this point, the more you look at it, the more it's obvious. But you just kind of have to let it kind of marinate every thought, and kind of that's what helps drive, that's what informs character, that's what informs plot, and everything starts to tick along by itself, and you're suddenly rolling downhill and going, holy shit, I just wrote a novel.
Wow, this is inspiring, actually. I like this.
But that first act, that first, like, huge act is just, what do you want to say to the universe? And, mm-hmm. like, my big rule is I never tell anyone, not even my editors, what that thing is for me for any given project. Now, what's funny is I ask my clients to, like, tell me because I'm trying to help them shape it. So it's a little unfair of me to not tell anyone else, but I'm also just a bastard. So what do you want?
No, but I think that that's right, because the thing that you don't want to do, the risk is being too explicit,
right?
Because then it loses any and all ability to influence. As soon as you think somebody's preaching to you or trying to manipulate your beliefs or, you know, draw you your own conclusion, then you kind of, the spell is broken.
Right. You've lost it.
Yeah. So I think that's the best fiction is that fiction that you don't even realize until you're done with it that, oh, yeah. And it starts to revisit you in conversations and in dreams and in your own writing. And then suddenly you're like, oh, shit, that's what that was about.
Right. And I mean, I've had people come to me and be like, oh, I really love the story. You know, I thought it was really interesting how it was saying this. And they tell me this thing and I'm sitting there going, I have never in my life considered this. I have never thought these thoughts. This has nothing to do with what I have done. And they would just be like, yeah, it's really, and I'll just be like, yeah, I'm really interested that you caught that. Because I'll never tell them they're wrong. Mm-hmm. Because it's what you took out of a thing. So it is correct. With the caveat of, if you come to me and say, like, you know, well, this is why I took out that, like, I don't know, gays are bad, I will tell you you're wrong when I'm hitting you with a chair. But... like, outside of, like, outright hate speech, generally, I'll just be like, oh, that's cool, and tell you you're absolutely right. That's exactly what I was going for. Because for you, it is. And that's completely valid. I have no control what anything I do and how it resonates in you. I cannot control that. I can control how it resonates for me and how that lands on the page.
Yeah.
After that, out of my hands. So whatever it does to you, absolutely, that's on you. Awesome. I will tell you are right, you know, and I'm always interested to hear it because I'm like, I cannot predict half of this.
Well, that's one reason why I'm so opposed to this idea of, you know, fine art and fine, you know, literature and all of that. Like, I understand that they conform to certain ideas about what is right, but I also think that the true purpose of writing, of fiction, of art, of poetry, of all of these things is first and foremost the self-expression of the person that's creating it, right? And second of all, it is a mirror, right? It's something that somebody picks up and looks into. And I used to find this very offensive, actually. I would be like, the only reason people like whatever I'm doing is because it makes them feel good about themselves or it affirms something that they believe. But actually, that's not, like, I don't know what the hell I was on. Like, yeah, that's actually a good thing.
Sure. I mean, look, I just grew up in these worlds, right? And I'm so used to people just being like, well, you know, it's my art. And I'm like, shut the hell up. You don't get to decide if what you're making is art. You don't.
Uh-huh.
That's not how art works.
Yeah.
You did a thing. That's all it is. It's a thing. And that's fine. You know, it, like, for me, I hope I just write something that's entertaining to somebody else other than me, usually like my editor. If I can make my editor laugh, I'm golden. If anyone else in the world reads this thing and they're like, well, we fucking hate it, I'm like, okay, my editor laughed. Like, I don't care. I have an audience of basically two, me and whoever my editor is that day. Like, that's it. Everything else is not my problem. And, you know, people have accused me of making art before, and I guess I won't argue, but yeah, you can't. I think it was Zappa who mentioned, you know, you need to take the music seriously and never yourself.
I think that's right.
Right. The actual craft has to be taken seriously and respected. but you can't take yourself seriously because
right.
At some point, again, I don't care what kind of, you know, art, and I'll use art as a, even though I'm like sitting there going, you can't say that, and as just kind of an umbrella term for, you know, photography, painting, drawing a comic, writing a thing, whatever it is. At a certain point, like, you're making money too. I used to actually describe, I was writing a all ages comic, and someone asked me like, oh, what do you do? I was like, I get paid to lodge children. And they just looked at me like the most horrified look I had gotten in a while. And like, because at some point, that's kind of true. It's as true as anything else.
Right, right. Okay. I wanna ask you about something that you said a little bit ago about, you know, you write these things and you're like, well, this could just be a 500-word blog post, right, or whatever. And I want to talk to you about how the internet and our online sort of reading habits have impacted and writing habits have impacted our ability to engage with long form fiction, and whether you think long form fiction still has a place. And I ask you this because, like I said, I went through a really long dry spell, and I work, you know, online, and I write for the internet, and I, you know, the rule is less is more, people don't want to read, blah, blah, blah. And it really sort of started to take away my joy in reading and writing. And then over the holidays, I started reading some fiction, some classic fiction. And, you know, you read something from the Victorian era and it's so extra.
Like, oh, right? Back when like, people oh got paid God. By the word.
But the thing is, like, those words actually make a difference. Like, they're not
not always.
Words are not extraneous. No, not always. But if it's done well, like, what I'm saying is, it's not just word count is not the most important thing.
No.
Whether and for or against, right?
Of like, course.
Less I is mean, or more.
Look,
but my point was, I just wanted to say this. Like, I like started falling in love with the language again because I started reading these lush passages and I was like, oh my God, it's so beautiful, right? And I would go back and reread them and just get chills. And then I would think, what has happened to me? Like, I literally tried to get everything down to the bare bones of communication, and it's gross.
I mean, ignoring the, and I, please, I do not mind, but ignoring the very large bus you are tossing at Hemingway's head. And again, fair. Man deserves it. I you have to say, like, all of my fiction actually comes from a basic building block of Spillane, who also needs, like, something large thrown at his racist, misogynist head. But, I mean, man could craft a sentence. You have to separate those things sometimes. It's not easy, but, you know, but again, like, there is something to be said for being able to construct sentences like that. But, I mean, I'll say, like, even if you divorce the internet aspect from it for a minute, mm-hmm. like, even growing up, for me at least, there was always that thing of, like, well, if you have the money to buy a book, are you going to buy the book that's this long or this long? Because, you know, one feels like it's a better value. And that's a weird thing when you notice you did it.
Yeah, that is weird.
And I've known people who've done that my entire life. And, like, I know I've done that once or twice. Where they're like, well, I don't want to buy this book because I'll finish reading it too fast.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean it's a lesser book, but it is an interesting thing. I mean, you know, novellas used to be published as individual product.
Yeah, I was having that same conversation. Like, you could, all of these little books, like even stuff like that's considered the classics or stuff that's like assigned in school, 1984 or Brave New World. These are very short books. Right?
Yeah.
And but so good, right? And so juicy and delicious. And yet, I don't know. Like, I feel like, I guess what I'm saying is we are under the impression that there's a right way to communicate. And I think that we've kind of boxed ourselves in. And maybe it's just me. Maybe I've boxed myself in. And to kind of go out and explore, every writer has a voice and a style, and some are just gorgeous, the long, you know, and they're wordy, and that's okay. I mean, right. I'm not trying to you know, throw buses at Hemingway.
No. Of course not. No, I'm
Oscar Wilde way more compelling than Hemingway, and Oscar Wilde can write some beautiful shit. But I mean, you could take one of his things and, like, you know, reduce it down to a 500-word blog post if you really wanted to.
And again, like, if you play with style, you can reduce or expand anything into anything, right? Because the ways of expression are limitless. But your point remains, and I think that this is a thing, but in terms of being told the right way, I don't think it's the right way. I think we're being told the current profitable way. This is something I've been tracking for a few years now, which is, if you look, like, fiction sales are kind of going up, but that's also a pandemic thing. Overall, they're kind of softening, and, like, even, you know, something like Amazon is backing things like Vella, right? We're going back to a subscription model where you get, and we're right back at Dickens, where you get serial novels, because people don't want to have, they're happy to read a 1,000-page book, right? But they don't want to be handed a 1,000-page book. They want to be handed 1,000-page books. Because if they feel like it's a 1,000-page book, it feels like too much of a commitment. And it's like watching a TV show. I want to watch one episode and then watch an episode of this other thing. I don't want to feel like I am hemmed into only watching this show. And that's a lot of what's happening. There is also some attention span stuff of, like, you know, YouTube into TikTok into, you know, 3-second things. Sure. It's also cyclical, right? Like, again, you look at the Victorian era, you had serial novels ruled the day, and then they didn't. And then you had the pulp novels, which were literally named because suddenly we could actually mass produce books on the cheap. And pulp novels were very short because paper, you know, cost money. And then you had the rise of things like novellas and short stories and these magazines. And then slowly that became longer and longer novels and gigantic series because paper was cheaper and books were selling. And then as bookstores started to vanish and it was harder and harder to browse because you can't browse websites like you can a bookstore. I don't care what anyone says. Your brain doesn't work that way.
It's true.
You had people falling off of discovering new things. So they would start, oh, how do I discover something? And then you start getting to the, well, I'm reading a lot of blogs, I'm watching a lot of this, whatever it is, and you slowly end up back at serial fiction. Okay, so we've come full circle from, like, the Victorian era to now. Awesome. How long does it last? I don't know. Audiobooks are just as much of a book as anything else. There are a lot of fiction podcasts that are doing really well. Are those serial fiction? I mean, they are, right? You wouldn't listen to a 100-hour single podcast episode, right?
Well, I might.
Well, fair. I'm not, but, like, in general.
Yeah, no, I get it.
In general, you'd want it.
Yeah, I get it.
Right. So I just feel like it's one of those things, like, it's a cycle, and we're just hitting a point, and it's going to come around, it's going to do what it does. I don't think there's any one right way to tell a story or to ingest one. But there is that sense that there should be. And as long as we have the sense that there should be, it's a moving target.
Do you think that it's, because you mentioned that you think a lot of this is rooted on, you know, like, what's profitable. But is it that readers are the ones that are defining the market, or are they just taking what publishers think is profitable and that's what you get, right?
It depends on the market segment. This gets into really weird, deep, dark, black magic publishing shit. Because you have, like, your traditional, like, essentially at this point, big, what, 4 publishers? Yeah. And let me tell you, they'll tell you what to read.
Exactly.
Then you have things like bookstores where you had Barnes & Noble where it was like $1 million to be on the front door table. They're telling you what to read. But then you have self-published stuff. And, well, now it's up to the reader to find it, and they're using things like whatever it is, TikTok or social media somewhere, you know, Twitter, Mastodon, it doesn't matter. But the rate of discovery is very low. And so you have things like Amazon's Vella program stepping in and helping you discover stuff, but then it's Amazon telling you what to read, isn't it?
Right.
So it feels like it's like, do you decide what movie to watch? Or do you decide what movie to watch based off of the options that are the loudest in your vicinity?
Dude, that's my soapbox, because I've been in marketing for so long. I'm like, you're not making your own decision. You think you are. And the reason why marketing actually works is because you know, people don't think they're susceptible to it. But yeah, like, there's so much good shit out there. And I say this especially in music, because music, we're going to talk about music. Music, I'm so, you know, interested in. And I mean, there are some amazing bands that are infinitely better than whoever you're seeing on stage at the Emmys or whatever, that whatever, not Emmys, what are they, what is it, what the fuck is it, the Grammys, yeah,
Grammys.
I don't watch these shows, but you know, these award shows,
sure.
And like, you see like some, there are some local acts that'll just blow your fucking mind and no one's ever heard of them, and it burns my ass that people might not ever hear of them because they're not being fed into this machine. It's like a fucking pyramid scheme. Like, you know, like, whoever has the money gets to say, oh, these are the lucky few, and who knows what goes into, I mean, there's all kinds of
right.
stuff that goes into how they make that decision, but it's not a reflection of value, and it's not a reflection of talent or quality. And that really, as a person who has so much passion for music, a non-musician who is passionate, a consumer of music, that just pisses me off. And I suppose that that's true of everything.
Course.
Like all creative endeavors. Right.
Well, and here's the thing. Sometimes the universe grants you one, like as a favor, where you can actually prove that, oh no, sometimes the system has holes in it. Again, I give you David Wong, right? Like, he self-published a novel in serial form on a website like around 2000 or so. Like, it was just, you know, before Cracked. And it got him jobs, and it got him a publishing deal to publish that novel. And he proved to the world that, oh no, my shit will sell, to the point where he now does that full time.
Yeah.
And it's like 7-8 novels.
Yeah.
In. It happens. Musically, it happens. And I can give you the band to prove it beyond all shadow of a doubt, because there is one.
Okay.
Wolfpack.
Oh, yep.
And what's fun is if you read all my ramblings about music, I will tell you that February is going to be a big month for that. And there might be an entire, like, I don't know, 1,000-odd word post just on Wolfpack. But, I mean, again, like, they've done the impossible, right?
Yeah.
This is a band who have never had a label.
Yeah.
They are beholden to no one but themselves. They all co-own the band equally. Well, the original four members do.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 years into their career, did a sold-out show at the Garden.
That's incredible. And you know, the only reason I know who they are is because a former coworker introduced me. Like, I never even really, you know, I had not found them before then. And I spend time looking around, right? I mean, I do. I try to, but it's not what's in your face. So you have to make a little bit of extra effort. But I will say that whether it's books or music or whatever, it is almost always the artists that I find through other people that I end up falling in love with.
Right. Yeah. Like, at the end of the day, you know, word of mouth is the great thing. And people can always feel like they're annoying their friends.
Uh-huh.
When they're just like shouting from the rooftop. It's like, no, if you love something, be it a book or a movie or TV show, I don't care what it is, I don't care how small it is, like, tell people about it, because that's the lifeblood.
Yeah. I want to hear from you more than I do some
else.
Jackass in the New York Times. I promise.
Sure. Right?
Whoever, they might not be a jackass, but you know what I'm
saying. Yeah, I get you. Like, I get you.
Okay, before we move on to music, I'm going to ask you one more thing. It was about our exchange that we had, and I really liked it, and it sort of helped me understand you a little bit as a creator. And hearing sort of your family background also has kind of filled in some of those blanks for me. But you're very, very practical about this, right? I think a lot of people approach any kind of artistic endeavor, but especially writing, there's a lot of mythology around it. And people approach it as if there's some kind of magic formula. And I remember you telling me, I can't remember the exact context or wording, but I remember you just being like, no, I just do it. There's no, I don't wait for the moment to strike. I don't get into the groove or whatever. I just do it and I make it happen, right? And I love that.
One of my great problems in the writing community, like, I joke that, like, I left New York because, like, the fiction community was ready to hang me. That's not true. Some of them, but not all of them. Because a whole lot of fiction writers, you know, have the whole, like, I was waiting for the magical inspiration fairies to come down and, like, you know, kiss my forehead. And I'm like, hey, shut the fuck up. Stop making this, like, some magical fairy dust thing. Because you know what? You're plying a trade. Okay? We are no more or less skilled than someone who's making a chair. And if you've never seen an amazingly handmade chair that will blow your mind, you have not lived. And that might sound ridiculous, but, like, let me tell you, expert, like, craftsmen can do amazing things.
Absolutely.
And that's all we're, it's a skill. It is, I often do relate it to furniture building. Like, I'm making a table. That's all, like, any good story. Yes, my categories. That's all.
Hi.
She's just behind
Welcome
me yelling.
To the show.
But that's all any good story is, right? Like, it's a piece of solid furniture, right? It needs to be able to stand up. It needs to be able to support some weight, perform its function. And that's all it is. It doesn't have to be pretty. It can be. You know, that's where you get into the stylistic language. Like, are you, you know, on the Hemingway side of things? Are you on, like, the big Gormaghast side of things with, like, you know, huge Gothic literature? Doesn't matter. You know, make your chair or your table how you see fit.
Yeah.
But it is a skill. It is not magic. Anyone, everyone on Earth, especially because of the internet nowadays, everyone writes things.
Yes.
And if you ever write an email to your friend or your, you know, some relative telling them about your day, you are telling them a story.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are our memories being kind of iffy in general, no shame. You are, at some level, inventing fiction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You are crafting a story. You have written a thing. You have written a story. You do this hundreds of times a year,
mm-hmm.
easily, without noticing it. Now, do you do it for, let's just say, 80,000 words in a row coherently? There are people who would argue that I don't either.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah, no, that is fine, you know? Right? No, because that's the other, like, sort of mythology, is that writing is done in isolation by some, you know, nerdy little person in a cottage by the sea who, you know, types out hundreds of pages of manuscripts and then just drops it at their editor's doorstep and gets published. Like, that ain't it. It is a team effort. And it's also a long ass process, right? Like, it takes time.
Oh, yeah. Right. And that's the thing. If you don't look at it as a craft, if you don't look at it as a marathon, not a sprint, if you don't look at it as something you're, it's work,
yeah,
then you are going to A, be horribly disappointed, but also you're going to hate the process.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Like, I mean, I love, you know, and everyone knows this too. Like, I think everyone who writes anything, right? We all love having written way more than we like writing. Cause the cool end is having written. That's the look at my book. You know, that's awesome. Because people assume you've done magic. But all of that, and this is where I started making enemies, all of the, this is the mythology, this is the, you know, look at me, I've done magic, the story gods have granted me the ability to weave this,
yeah,
you know, magical tale from the ether. They are trying to fool you because they would not like you to understand that you can do it too.
Uh-huh. And maybe even better.
They are trying to hold them, right. Right. They are trying to hold the magic for themselves because they are scared little children.
Mm.
And they can go to hell.
Oh! Ooh.
Because everyone can write. And if you never want to, if it's not a skill you feel like learning, you're not going to be great at it. That's fine. There are many things I appreciate that I do not ever put in the time to learn the skill. But if you want to, you can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an innate ability people have predilections towards certain things.
Yeah, for sure.
Sure. But natural skill will get you maybe a tenth of the way anywhere.
Yep.
I don't care who you are. I don't care what it is.
Yep.
Backbreaking, stupid, annoying work will get you the rest of the way. Every time. Every time. No matter the skill, there's never any magic. Like, you want to be the best trombone player in the world? That's fine. It could take 20 years. But if you spend 20 years with the dedication of, I'm going to be the best trombone player in the world, let me tell you something, in about 20 years, you're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be open to what it takes and putting in the work every day and never feeling like you're good enough and always fighting. And it's just, it's, again, it's a slog. It's not this magical thing that, you know, how many writers have stories about, like, that have main characters who are writers who, like, wrote some story and are now billionaires? I love those. I love those so much. Because, again, they're trying to enforce this fictional idea that, like, look how cool we are. When it's like, no, we're just assholes who don't get along with other people, so we need to be alone with our fictional friends, who we have to invent because your fictional friends aren't good enough for us. We need our own.
Amazing. You know what? What am I saying? Of course you know Ray Bradbury. He wrote a book about...
I mean, not personally.
No, I mean, but... well, I would hope not. He wrote a book about, I think it was called The Zen of Writing, and in it... He talks about it's autobiographical, and he just talks about his process and his, you know, he didn't go to college. He didn't train to be a writer, but right. He told, you know, in the book, he was like, well, here's the deal. I lived in this house with my family and my wife and I like would get up every day. I'd have breakfast and then I would go sit at my desk and I would treat it like my job. And I sat there and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. And that's how it happened. Right.
And he had the money to do it.
Well, he did it. Like, that's part of the story.
Well, I'm just saying, but like, that is part of it. You know, like Walden book, the Walden Pond myth. Yeah, right.
Yeah. No, but that.
That he went down to Walden and it leaves out that his family was like feeding him and taking care of him. Yeah.
No, but the point was that it wasn't there's plenty of, you know, admission there that he was working, you know, he was eking his way by. And, you know, obviously that if you do want to be a writer, you have to have the express support of your family if you're going to devote that much time to it. And I don't mean financial support either. Like, your family has to be willing to be like, yeah, we're not going to have everything we want because we're trying to do this thing. But yeah, like, the point being that he treated it like a job. Like, he took it seriously and he just went and he did it. And it wasn't like he was waiting for some magical thing to happen. And I appreciated that very much from him.
Yeah. One of my favorite editors I've ever worked with breaks it down into, she thinks of it in terms of, weirdly enough, planes more than furniture, which is fine. And she always joked that, like, I'm a great mechanic, and she was a great engineer. And this makes sense to my head, because, again, she was editing. Like, she needs to be an engineer. She needs to be able to figure out, like, how do we get from A to B? But I could just, you give me a pile of parts, and I'll make something out of it. And everyone I know who is dead serious about this stuff, and, like, a serious, like, and not that, this is terrible of me. I know a lot of very successful authors and successful, you know, artists in general who ascribe to the big mythical worldview. And God bless them, I guess. I don't know. But I promise you they don't think of it that way at when they're alone in the dark.
Right.
And everyone I count as like somebody I would go to for advice or someone whose work I would push on other people, we're mechanics. We're furniture builders. We're craftsmen. It's a trade. That's all it is. And I think if we taught it that way, instead of as this mythical thing, we'd be way better off.
I agree. And I think that the other thing is that it is a team effort, right? Like you were saying, you work with your editor. That person is an essential sounding board for you. My teacher at my Zen center is writing a book. And, you know, she's in her 70s. She ran the writing center at UT for years. I mean, she knows what the fuck she's doing. She's not, like, if anybody can write, this woman can write. And yet, she's taking a, you know, this coaching course with this, you know, renowned writer who is kind of helping her on this particular project with a group in a small cohort of like five or six other people. The point being, she's humble enough to recognize that nobody does this kind of stuff on their own. Even if you have that much experience or that much raw talent, you still have to have support and feedback
and a community. Right? Like,
yeah.
And also, you can never be so full of yourself that you stop learning. Yep. Even from like people who are brand new. You know, I don't care if you've, like, you know, this is my first novel. It's like, cool, show me something. Uh-huh. Like, and it's not like a dare or anything bad. It's, no, literally, like, what are you doing? Because your experience is going to be different than mine. And you might have just stumbled on something that I'm like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be open to it. It's why I still keep my hand in editing, frankly, because I tend to only take, like, usually self-published clients and clients who can't really afford editors, but are usually like on their first book. Because I figure if I can help them just kind of get on that path and be like, okay, I can figure out what I'm doing. I can go somewhere. Like, they're the people who are going to invent the next big thing. Yeah,
that's awesome. It really is. I mean, and I think that that's right. I mean, I have a really good friend who was a visual artist for many years and never considered herself a writer. And then a few years ago, she started cartooning. And then she decided, oh, I'm going to actually write a book around this, right? And so she started writing and quickly realized she needed that community. And now she's kicking and she's winning like awards. She's like doing all kinds of stuff. But the right. key was she had to put herself in an environment where people are it's non-competitive and yet there are standards and people are going to hold you to them.
That's the thing, right? Like no one I know who makes, because I live in Portland, right? Comicstown USA at the moment. And I actually don't work in comics as much anymore, right? Currently, just because of the world. But even so, like the comics community out here, like they're not my competition.
Right.
Right. Like all the writers I know, none of us are in competition with each other. Because the truth of it is, I could be in, like, you could pick a writer out that you're like, well, maybe I'm better than him, maybe I'm worse than her. And you could pick someone out of a crowd and be like, they're my competition. Sure. Your only competition is the last thing you did. Everything you do should be, if you're doing this right, better than the last thing you did. You should be able to look back every 5 to 10 years and be horribly embarrassed by everything you've done.
That's good to know.
Like, that's natural, right? Like, I mean, again, think of, you think like Beethoven didn't do that? Come on. That's the trick. You have to allow yourself the grace to be embarrassed by it, but, you know, understand that some people still love it, and that's fine. You cannot be negative toward it in public.
Yeah.
You never shit on things people like, especially when you did them. And it's an easy thing to do, but you're embarrassed by it. No, but it was like their favorite thing. And I have a project like that I'm like, I am kind of embarrassed by the project. And I have a friend who that is their favorite thing I've ever done.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, and we're good enough friends that I've told them this. I'm just like, it makes me laugh every time. Because I just want to be apologizing for this thing. Just be like, well, you know, it's kind of crap here. They're like, shut up, I love this thing. I'm like, you know what? I cannot say it's crap. You love it.
Yeah, but that's actually the good thing, right? That's what makes it
right.
So that's what makes creativity and creation so beautiful and so human, is that you have the process yourself, right, as the creator. And that is the thing that is molding you and teaching you and forcing you to grow. Then you have the product, which you can then feel good about and share out with the world. And then you have the stuff that the reactions that other people have. And like you said at the very beginning, like they're usually based on that person's own interpretation, right? And so it has sort of a completely different life after that. So it goes through this evolutionary process where it's something within you, something outside of you, and then it's something that inhabits other people. And that's righteous, actually.
Yeah, like one of my favorite book series ever, the Reathu series by Storm Constantine, was foundational for me as a teenager. Like, I just found them in a bookstore. I found the first one, you know, randomly in a bookstore, the way you do. Well, or you did, I guess, back then.
I still do.
And it was just game-changing for me, right? Like, it just worked. Things clicked in my head. And I grew up, like, loving these books. And later in life, I actually got to know Storm, who has since sadly passed. But, like, you know, we were never close friends, but there's that surreal moment of hanging out with Storm, because she was, you know, over from the UK. And I'm just, like, telling her, like, you know, this was, like, foundation when I was, like, you know, like 12 or 13. And she's looking at me, she's like, stop reminding me that I'm older than you. Like, just stop it. Just stop doing that right now. But, you know, sometimes you get the luck, right, to get to meet the people who did a thing that is foundational for you. And you can explain to them, like, this is a thing that influenced me, not only, like, in my life, but also in certain ways in how I create. And here's where I saw the tools you were using, and here's how, in my head, and to reduce it to weird terminology, like, that I saw you holding a chisel, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I couldn't see, but it's like, here's how you built a paragraph, and here's how I reverse engineered it. Now, was this how you actively, consciously built the paragraph? Who knows? Uh-huh. But it's how I reverse engineered it, and then went forward and started doing it myself.
Well, I'm sure that that's the most rewarding thing you can tell someone who's a writer or an artist, yeah. Right?
No, it's mind-blowing to ever hear it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's also fascinating to watch people invent tools based on what they thought you were doing. Yeah. Because you could sit there and be like, that's not a chisel as man knows it. You know, it just, but it doesn't matter. It does the job.
Yeah. No, I think that's wonderful. It is a, I don't know. I mean, I will say the actual craft of writing is not magic, but what it actually does between people, I think is pretty magical. It is a beautiful thing that just sparks. And I think one of the cool, I had this kind of come to Jesus moment with myself recently because I started writing again too. And I love it. Like I've always written, I love doing it, but you know, I always thought, well, you know, I'm never going to be like this well-known writer. I have stories to tell, but you know, whatever. I mean, who, you know, like, is it worth the effort? And then I remember that growing up, I read everything I could get my hands on. And yeah, I read some of the big names, a lot of the big names, and I read big fiction, but I also read a lot of just crap that I found. And some of that crap, and I'm using the quotation marks around crap.
Right. Right. No, you're using it lovingly. Yeah, right. I understand.
Like pulp, like stuff. And it like turned me on. I was like, this is amazing. Right. Like it had an impact on me. And so then that was the moment when I was like, am I writing because is it my ego that wants me to write, or am I writing out of the sheer joy of doing it and offering it up to a gift with the confidence that somebody will find value in it because they will.
And again, what you've encountered is the having written versus writing split. Like that is how it manifests, right? Like on some hand, and I can feel the same too. And I have in the past, like, you know, if I write this thing, like, you know, are more people going to read it? And that's the, I want to have written.
Right.
I want to, you know, have this thing out in the world. I want people to react to it versus I want to do this thing.
Yeah.
And I'm going to segue us for you in a weird way, because I can tell you like a lot of the blog posts that I do, because I started using my blog again, mm-hmm. you know, late last yeah. year into this year. Because I always just liked it. Like, I used to write articles for people and get paid for it and all this stuff. And I just kind of like the, I'm just going to write some shit. And mostly I've been writing a lot recently, and this will change throughout the year, but still, a lot about music, partially because when you work with prose and comics, it's hard to talk about them. Because mm-hmm. you don't want to put anything down, because those are people you know. And you know they meant well. And again, why would you just punch a friend in the face? Right. It's not cool. And I have another podcast where we talk about movie stuff, so I'm not going to write about movies. And so I'm like, well, what am I writing about? And I was like, well, you know, the other thing I love more than anything, which is music. But I can tell you the amount of work some of these posts take is like literal weeks.
Yeah.
Of just, you know, writing out a draft and then refining it and trying to figure out and like finding the right track to put with this thing. Can I tell you things like my, you know, like my top 10 list of the year,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Less than 100 people read that.
Yeah. But the thing is...
But it doesn't stop me. It doesn't... I'm not doing it for the people reading it. I'm doing it because it brings me joy to just put the stuff out there with the... You know what? Maybe someone who created this album that is affecting me this much
yeah.
might get to see it. Maybe someone who stumbles on this will go out and buy that album.
Yeah. No, that's right. That's right. It's not, and I think that we are so indoctrinated with this idea of scale right now because of the internet, right? And I will definitely blame the internet for that. I mean, yes, it's always sure. been that way, but we feel like if we're not reaching literally millions of people, then we've failed. And the reality is that it's not necessary, and you can just do things for the joy of it, and it can make a difference in people's lives anyway. And that's why I was so like, I was in on the early blogging scene, and that's why I loved it so much, right? Is like, it's a low bar, low pressure. You just get to write for fucking fun, right? And
exactly.
And the thing is, it's not like a limited resource. The more you do it, the more you want to do it. And I see it as like, if you are a person that writes or has aspirations to write, you should have a blog. Like, or if you don't want to put something out publicly, have a personal kind of journal or blog, but be writing
every day. You can install a WordPress thing. You can have the stuff be private. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know how to make the post public. But yeah, again, like play with stuff, play with words, play with ideas, see what fits you. And yeah, it's like, I stopped at some point. I made the choice to not pursue writing as my day job. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, 10 odd years ago? Because it meant that I would never, because again, I grew up with people who were on this grind, mm-hmm. but it meant that I would never have to say yes to a gig in order to pay my rent.
Oh, good, 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 good.
And it's not some sort of thing of like, oh, I am purer than you. It's just one of these like, no, I'm just lazy and an asshole.
No, but also you know what you need out of the process, right? And I agree with that. Like, I feel the same way. I don't want to write for a living. I want to write.
I mean, it'd be nice. Like, again, like there was that thing of like, it'd be kind of nice, but also it's not where my head is.
And also you have to.
And part of the reason I started.
It's the pyramid scheme. Like, look, everybody wants to be a writer, right? And to make a lot of money at it. But like very few people get to do that. Even if you're good,
sure,
right? So then the question is, does that mean you don't write anymore? No, you still write.
I know people for who that's true. Aww. And, you know, again, everyone has to make their own choices. But, you know, like when I picked up specifically blogging, it was I don't care. And I've had talks with a friend like, you know, oh, maybe I should do like some like SEO stuff on my site. And then I look back and I have a post that's like, SEO is bullshit on my site. I'm like, that's amazing. Like 2013 me was already slapping 2023 me. Perfect. I came prepared. But it is that thing of like, you know, if 5 people read a thing, that's cool. If 5 people read a thing and one person kind of likes it, cool. You know, I made as much impact as I would have if I had just talked to that one human being. And I mean, that's enough impact. Whatever. What else would I have been doing with my time? I think my big rule in life is conscious creation, right? Whatever it is you choose to do, however you just do it with your eyes open. Know what you're doing. Like, I can respect someone who, you know, oh, I just do this to make money. I don't give a shit about it. It's just what brings in the money. That's cool. As long as you know it. If you're fooling yourself that, like, that's not what you're doing and that's totally what you're doing, then I feel bad and I'm worried about you. But if that's what you're doing and that's what you want to do, go with God. Enjoy.
Nice.
Might not be for me, but that's cool. Hope it works out. But you want to talk about music.
Yeah.
See, sorry. I'm pulling us back. No, I'm pulling us back.
This is the problem. This is the problem with the podcast. It's like there's... And I know you have to leave at some point.
Also, I'm a wordy bitch.
No. But I just want to say right now that at some point you can come back. Like, we don't have to fit every... Because we didn't even... Like, food isn't even on the agenda at this point. But sure. Like, you have to come back and talk about
food.
But
we can talk music. And if I run a little late, I do. It's a kind of self-imposed deadline. I'll be fine.
All right. So I live in Austin. You live in Portland. I think we know that music is pretty important. I think we know that indie music is really important. I mean, all music is important, but I'm really passionate about these folks that are doing it for the same reason that people write, you know, that they're just, it's what they want to do. It's what they want them. Some of these,
they can't not. Yeah,
exactly. And they, you know, if they have to deliver pizzas or work in a shitty marketing job to pay the bills while they get to do this, that's what they're going to do. Talk to me about what was it that sort of formed your relationship to music, and how did you decide that it was something that you just had to write about on a regular basis?
Well, my father could play piano by ear. This is kind of disturbing when you're growing up. Because, like, literally, you know, we'd be watching a TV show and be like, I like this TV show, you know, little idiot kid me. And my father would be like, okay, walk over to the piano and start playing the theme song. It's weird. Yeah. And, you know, he loved a lot of jazz, loved a lot of, like, early American musicals. So I grew up with these things. And still actually love both. Like, I think I still know the entire score to Barnum by heart.
Oh. Do you play?
Well, and that's the thing, is that there's a number of reasons why not really. I had, like, a bunch of piano lessons and some guitar lessons when I was a kid. I used to kind of drum when I was little because, as my father said, I was cheaper than a metronome. And then a lot of that fell away. And then I tried to pick things like guitar back up, but I've had a weird life and my left hand is, there's a little bit of nerve damage in there. So, you know, not exactly a thing. But I also know way more about like music theory and everything else than most people who don't play. Like that's the thing, is people assume that I am a musician. Because I can talk to them in their own language. It's just I just currently don't.
Okay. So talk to me about then how you still manage to make it such a central part of your life.
I can't function without music. Yeah. Like I firmly believe, I've always said that, like, you know, the reason we invented fire was so that we could tell stories to each other longer into the night.
Uh-huh.
Like everything human comes from storytelling.
Yep.
It is the essential human thing. But of course we were banging rocks together before we had fire. Music is on some level the essential storytelling of humanity. It predates anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love story in all form. I've dedicated my life to it in a certain respect in more than one form. I had to pick a road, right? Because everyone, again, when you're looking at skills, you kind of have to, I mean, I know a lot of things about a lot of things, but if you want to get really good at a thing, you have to choose and just head down and go. So I chose writing instead of music, which, I don't know, maybe I made the wrong choice. But for me, like, I can't, like, I write to music. I can't not. Like, I have music playing all the time. If I'm cooking, there's music. If I'm just hanging out with people, there's music. I always worry because I have friends who are just like, oh, I'm just listening to the same, like, 15 bands since I was in high school. And I'm like, well, they put me in the ground.
Yeah.
you know, I discover new bands, like, monthly, if not faster.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's just the way my brain is. I need to.
Like, how do you do it?
Just talking to friends, like, what are you listening to? B, I spend a bunch of time on, like, you know, all of the, like, Bandcamp stuff with, you know, like, here's some stuff on, like, the new experimental music this week. Here's whatever, because I don't care about genre. You know, here's all that stuff. So I read all of that. I read a bunch of different, like, you know, Enemy stuff still. Rolling Stones reviews, which have gone downhill. But just a bunch of different music review sites, a bunch of, you know, again, things like Bandcamp. And sometimes I'll just go through Bandcamp and just be like, okay, the first, like, 30 new things that I haven't looked at yet, I'm going to stop and listen to a track from each.
Mm-hmm.
I had a rule since the 90s, actually, back when, you know, we went into music stores and bought music, that every time I buy, if I have money enough to buy a CD, I can't go to a music store unless I have enough money to buy two. If I buy two CDs, I still have to buy one extra. If I buy three, I have to buy two extra. Mm-hmm. And it kind of cycles up from there. And the extras were always a band I have never heard of that I cannot listen to at the time and that I am picking semi-randomly. Like, maybe the album art is cool. Maybe the band name is nice. Maybe they have a cool song title.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't matter. But I have to, like, pick. And I have found some of my most hated and most loved bands that way over the years.
Uh-huh. Yep.
I still do that now when I go to music stores, actually. Like, there's always that, like, one or two extra things that are completely random to me. It's harder these days because I don't stream music.
Oh, you don't?
No, I buy music.
But now
I believe in paying people.
No.
I firmly believe in paying people. Experimental stuff. I'm just saying, even my experimental stuff, if I'm like, well, I've listened to three tracks, I think this may be worth it. Well, I have nothing but regrets. That's on me. Cool. I buy a lot of books. Here's the thing. I don't stream books.
Yeah, yeah.
I buy a lot of books that I don't like. Why should music be different?
Yeah. No, I understand. I understand.
So, yeah, I pay for things. I don't stream music. So, you know, it's a little harder now, like, buying a bunch of stuff on, like, Bandcamp. And I tend not to buy stuff on, like, iTunes or anything like that just because DRM. But buying MP3s sometimes instead of going to the music store and buying CDs, because there are a lot of things that are on the fringes that, you know, there's only so much physical space any store can have. And I refuse to go back to vinyl. I grew up with vinyl. I rebought stuff on cassette. I rebought those same things on CD. I then have sometimes rebought those same things on MP3. I refuse to rebuy them again on vinyl and just start it over. That's just madness. And so, you know, there's some discovery slowed down if I'm not going to a music store, right? Because it's a little harder. Bandcamp is great for that, but other places aren't. in the same way if it's hard to browse Amazon for books.
Yeah. But it's active work.
Yeah,
you know, I do that. I actually, Bandcamp is really, that's probably the primary place where I find new music, right? Aside from my friends and like, you know, the blogs and whatever. But like, if I'm looking to buy or looking to discover something new, I hang out on Bandcamp and just search things up and, you know, sample different things. And I've found such good stuff. And I buy vinyl from there too. I mean, I like vinyl, but like I buy directly from there. I know. And I'm not a hipster, I promise.
No. Look. I have great friends who love the vinyl thing. And part of me is like, that's great. I don't have one single place I listen to music. Uh-huh. My house is not very soundproof. So I'm like, if I had a great stereo system to listen to vinyl, because I'd need one. It wouldn't all work out for me.
I
still kind of want to go there with certain things, but whatever. It's like I have, you know, a few of my friends, like it's just that you can follow people, like actual friends on Bandcamp.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look at like what their wish list is and what they've just bought, and I'll get ideas from that.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a really good idea. I should be full. In fact, let's do that. Let's put your, because you sent some stuff, which
on my site, actually.
Okay.
On the sidebar of my site, if you're like looking at any post, there are links to social media places. I might be the only person I know who actually does have a Bandcamp link there.
Oh, that's awesome. So in the show notes for this podcast, I'll put links to all your stuff. And so if you're listening, you should go follow Adam on Bandcamp, which I will also do as soon as we're done with this. Because I love that idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, it's more fun because you're just like, you know, like, well, what are you buying? What are you listening to today?
Mm-hmm.
It is active work to constantly find new music. It's a choice you make.
But, you know, isn't that part of, I don't know, maybe it's because we grew up pre-internet and we didn't have the ability to, but it's almost like that's part of the fun of it is the search and discovery. It's like going to the thrift store. I love thrifting because I have no idea. It's a discovery process, right? And when you do find something, you're just like, oh yeah, I discovered this thing. And I think that that's true with music. Like when I, like growing up or whatever, yeah, we had top 40 and this and that, but it was almost always through your friends. I had friends that would buy like imports and all kinds of, you know, crazy stuff that nobody had ever heard of and like turn them into, you know, mixtapes for us. And like it was fun.
See, that's interesting. Because growing up, I didn't.
Oh my God. Really?
Like, okay. My father was like big into like jazz and you know, like show tunes and I, Lord knows, inherited both of those things. But when it came to like popular or not popular music, you know, other music outside of those two venues, I like my friends didn't really listen to much music.
Wow.
And so, I mean, there was MTV, right? Sure. Uh-huh. You discover stuff that way.
Yeah.
And there's the occasional thing that you hear from like a friend. And maybe you hear something on the radio or because, you know, I grew up near, maybe you're going to the store and they're playing something. Fine. But a lot of it was just, I just spent a lot of time in Tower Records. And like that was how I did that I brute forced it.
Well, I mean, I think that says something, right? Like it says something about one, that it's, you know, there's an appeal there for you that goes beyond just the consumption of music. I mean, you have to really enjoy the process of looking for music if you're going to dedicate yourself to it that much. And it is. It can be pleasurable. I feel the same way. And I feel the same way about bookstores. Like, I want to just sit my ass in a bookstore or a library. Any place where I'm surrounded by these tactile sort of representations of media and play with them and see what looks good, see what feels good in my hand, and just then go with it. And that is a discovery process, I have to agree. But it's not something that, like, our modern day is easy.
Sure.
You have to actually work even harder now to seek those experiences out.
And that's part of why I started writing about music on the blog. Besides the fact that, again, as I mentioned, like, it was almost one of the only avenues left, which is a little weird. But it was also something I missed, right? Like, I have been paid to review movies in my time. I have been paid to review comics and novels and TV shows. I have weirdly never been paid to review music.
Hmm. Do you want
to
be?
Never got offered to me.
Oh.
I part of me does, because I just think that, you know, I don't tend to write like single album reviews on the blog. Maybe I should. I feel like if I really got into it, I could leverage all the writing stuff and all the music stuff and get something really interesting. But part of me is also like, no, music is, it's the part of why I didn't choose to become a musician, I think, is that music is, and this sounds weird, almost sacred, right? Like, it's this thing that I will quietly dedicate my life to appreciating and spreading and diving into and trying to understand and working with. And, you know, like, again, like, I plot stories to music. I plot stories because I see plot in shapes. I know this is weird. And I can relate music to those shapes.
Yep.
Like, you know, certain plot moves are like, oh, well, this is this weird kind of rhombusy type shape that's in my head. And, oh, this 45 seconds of this one song from this obscure 1972 Japanese, you know, vampire soundtrack happens to fit that shape, so I need that.
Yeah.
That album, by the way, exists. It is a really weird, there was a vampire Japanese fiction thing that had a TV show or a movie made about it, and they did this weird like neo funk soundtrack to it.
Right on.
That was then really out of print. It came back into print a couple years ago. It is surreal.
I gotta check it out.
But again, like, I think music is just kind of that, like, it's just I'm not very religious in my day-to-day life, right? Mm-hmm. And when I say very, I mean kind of any. My religious background is weird and strange, and I've written about it on the blog. But I think the only time I've ever sat there and gone like, oh, that's religion, was leaving Boston on a bus to go back to New York at sunrise.
Yeah.
With Tom Waits' All 55 blaring in my headphones.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment, looking out over the Mass Pike as the sun came up, listening to that song, that's religion.
Yeah. No, I am on your train, my friend. I 100% dig what you're saying.
And it's just, yeah, so I kind of don't want to be paid for it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, I want to keep it ideologically pure, which is bullshit, because you can still make money off of these things.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is some level where I want to just do the thing.
But you were talking about this earlier, right? Like, we all have predispositions, and it's okay that you don't want, like, there's people that's, they're happy being music journalists. They appreciate music. I'm not saying they appreciate it more or less, but it does something different, right, maybe for them or in a different way. And I agree with you. Like, it's the foundation of my life. I have friends that do not listen to music. Like, their houses are constantly quiet. I can't even imagine living this way. Like, all the time I'm listening to music. And sometimes I just listen to it, like, as I'm doing work. Sometimes I sit down and listen to it because I want the experience of just enjoying that sound. And it influences everything about my life. My life is set to music, at least in my head.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, and that's the trick of it, right? And yeah, and so it ends up coming on the blog with this, like, you know, well, here's some stuff I'm listening to this month. And shocking the amount of people who did not care about that.
What?
Write about the history of ray guns and hypocrisy, people will respond.
Ugh.
Write about, like, here's some music I like this month, people are like, that's awesome for you, go away.
Right.
And I say that, except, you know, I happen to know that, like, I actually sold one album off of that, so hey. But that's actually why, and it's not everything, and if I can't get the links because they're not on, but why I always drop specifically Bandcamp links. Because I'm like, well, if you like this thing, like, it's like a click. It's just a click.
Yeah.
You too can own it.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think, I mean, that's what I'm talking about, right? About the way to look, the way to find really great stuff is, in my opinion, it's through other people. And I just, it's shocking to me how even in the age of social media, where we're supposed to be all networked with our friends and be, you know, talking to them about stuff, we're still largely being, you know, our choices are being largely driven by marketing and, you know, very well-funded marketing, as opposed to people just sitting around and, like, having those conversations. I'm lucky because I do live in Austin and I have this, you know, group of friends who, you know, we blog together, we go see shows together, you know, we are a community. And so I get to hear about this stuff on texts and whatever. And like, we have private conversations all the time about this stuff.
Right.
But it's just not like, to me, that's not a normal scene. It is when you're like, maybe not in your case, but like, that's the same situation I had when I was a teenager. We devoted so much time to listening to music.
Right. and that's, for me, it was like around 20.
Yeah.
Where I first moved in with a roommate who also loved music, and that's when it started to blossom and became a thing.
Yeah.
That's where the extra CD rule came out, right?
Yeah. Hey. It's a communal thing. And you're right. And it stems back to the roots of it, the origin of it, right? Music is a communal thing. It's meant to be consumed in community. I mean, I listen to plenty of music alone, but like, there's nothing like seeing live music with a group of people.
Oh, God. It is. Look, the three things I used to do to just kind of, you know, exist would be go to shows, mm-hmm. like, you know, music, go to movies, and hang out in bars regardless of who I'm drinking.
Interesting. Why?
Okay. Music, again, as you described, right? Like, this is one of the great communal joys of anyone's life.
Yeah.
Is going to a great show.
Yep.
Hell, going to a mediocre show.
Amen. Right.
I don't care who's playing. I don't care what genre they are. I don't care if I ever heard of them before tonight. I'm going to have me a good time at that show.
Right.
Okay. Movies, same thing. You're in a theater. You are sharing this experience. It is larger than life. It is louder than life. You are getting this raw, uninterrupted story. You don't have your phone. You don't have anything to distract you. You are just receiving story at like 60 frames a second. That's it. That is your entire existence for the duration of that movie.
Yeah. But then why is it so good when you go with people? Like, why is the movie...
Well, because then it enhances the community aspect, right? Uh-huh, then it's right. Like, well, we've all been drugged this way, right? Like, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I'll go see a movie myself, I'll go to a concert myself, but I'd always rather go with people because this way you get to walk out of there and be like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, it's a thing.
Yeah.
Hang out in bars. Okay. I don't care if I'm drinking or not. I spent a bunch of years not drinking, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, bars are the concerts and movies of people.
That's amazing. Okay.
Because if you ever want to see just humanity on the small scale, just sit in a bar for like 7 hours.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is, when I used to, especially like when I was in New York, like I would go to bars, I would sit in the bar. Like I'd get to know the staff, we'd hang out. There's actually a bar down in New York that was a jazz bar, so I have music every night. But like it got to the point where like I was there for like once a week for like 7 odd hours in a shot. Like I helped train some of their staff. I used to get there when they would open and help set up the bar.
Amazing.
But it's because again, like you just sit there and you just watch humanity unfold.
Yeah.
Because people at a bar always act like they are in a booth at a restaurant by themselves and can't be overheard. And they're drinking, so they're not thinking about it.
Yeah.
And they stop thinking they're in public. And it is the storytelling of humanity. It is amazing.
That's fantastic. I think you're right. And there's actually a term for this. It's collective effervescence. And it's often used in the context of like religious community or religious experience. Right. But it's, you know, it's a psychological, you know, concept. And it applies in all of these areas, right? Where you're with people and there's an energy that starts to flow and you become, you know, a collective. And what that does is it helps your ego drop away and you realize, you know, you suddenly you have this, whether you're conscious or not, you realize this sort of commonality between you and other people and it brings you great joy.
So here's the fun fact. Last 3 years, you know what I haven't done at all?
Oh.
Any of those three things.
Has it been rough?
Oh, I've gone insane.
Uh-huh. Yep.
I'm pretty sure the damage is permanent.
No.
But, you know, is what it is. One day, hopefully, if people make smart choices, I can go back to at least some of this. Like, one of my favorite acts was actually in town, and it was heartbreaking because he puts up a bunch of clips. There'll be a post about him later in February.
Yeah.
I will just tell you, February, F is for funk. And 3 weeks of this, let me tell you. But he was in town, and he posts a lot of videos from live shows.
Yeah.
And I'm, like, watching this. I'm like, I know that. Oh, damn it, that's Revolution Hall. Oh, I could have been there. You know, it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Also, no. Revolution Hall is a really cool venue in Portland. It used to be a high school.
Oh, really? So, you know,
and now
I'm
it's like some
there.
Shopping stuff in the actual music place is actually a high school auditorium.
That's amazing.
Like all
I'm
the original seating
so
and everything.
I need you to tell me like where to look for, because I'd love to see some music while I'm in town. And I want all the recommendations from you, because I think,
I said, like Revolution Hall really is like my first choice of just like, it's such a fun venue.
Mm-hmm.
But like so a lot of that after that is just like, there's big stuff downtown. That's always good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
I haven't been in a couple years because, well, there's this pandemic.
I know. All right, well, Adam, this has been a fruitful. Can I say fruitful? Does that even sound right? Is fruitful okay?
Yeah.
It's words are words. Cheesy.
Look, you know how many words Shakespeare invented? We're fine. Ain't no one ever called him on his bullshit. So we're good.
Okay, excellent. No, it has been a fruitful conversation. I really enjoy talking to you. And we have much more to talk about. So at some point, you'll have to come back. Is there anything you would
we
like
can
to
talk
tell
food?
My entire listening audience of, you know, 12 people?
I will say music themed and concert themed. And for those who aren't going to concerts right now, the single most weirdly immersive concert video I have ever seen in my life, which is also just great musically, is Wolf Peck's live at Madison Square Garden. And it is all just on YouTube for free, but they had someone they know film it on an iPhone on just a gimbal in their hand from the stage. So there's just somebody running around the stage and moving it, so you feel like you are on stage.
Wow.
It is an experience unlike any concert video I have ever seen.
Awesome.
So there you go.
I need to see it, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Also, it is just an amazing because you're watching seven people and a few friends who, again, no label, nothing, 6 years into starting this thing, are at a sold-out show at the Garden, and it's sold out for them.
Yeah.
Like, just the sheer joy on their face, it comes through every note.
That's awesome. I saw Spoon, like, 2 years after, like, the pandemic, and then after 2 years, they finally let up, and we thought it was over for about a week, and Spoon played here, and they did a local show, which means that the tickets were like $20 each for locals, right? And you had to you got a limit of two, and you had to get, you know, it was like a thing for their fans, right? Because they're from Austin. And holy fuck, was it a show? It was a show. You could tell like that pent up like it was just amazing.
One of the best bands in the world that I think the only time they've ever been in the U.S. has been Austin. They might be coming back to Austin. I don't know yet.
Yeah?
And I am just preemptively angry that I will not get to see them again because they don't tour the U.S. They just show up for stuff in Austin every few years. But if you ever see that, you can actually go to and get ready for this band name, Tokyo Ska Paradise Orchestra.
Oh, okay.
They have been around for over 25 years. Their music is surreally good. And yeah, they just occasionally show up in Austin instead of Japan every now and then.
How weird and amazing. I love that. I love eccentric.
But if you ever
artists.
Get the chance and you don't take it, I will be personally just upset on your behalf.
Understood. Understood. I accept your challenge, sir. I will not let you down.
And on that note.
Yes, on that note. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Definitely talk again. If I have a chance to see you when I'm in Portland, that will be amazing. If not,
yeah,
that's
let me
cool.
know. We'll figure something
come
out.
Come to Austin. And I'll see you on the Mastodon. And anyone who wants to join us on Mastodon is welcome to do so as well. I'll put a link to that to our server on the show notes as well. So, Adam, thank you, my friend. I hope you have a great evening.
Thank you.
May your ZD succeed.
Oh, yeah, I have to go cook now, don't I? Right, that's a thing. Shift the gears.
Yeah.